Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show from All Sides where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. The Tony Awards are Broadway's big night. When they award stars of the stage, and they give out the awards on the TV screen, exposing a larger audience to the world of theater. For actress Tala Hash, this year's Tonys meant the first ever Tony nomination of her career. The performance that got her this remarkable milestone came from the original play, English, which centers on four adults from Iran seeking to pass the English as a foreign language test, and what that means for their futures and their cultural roots. The show was nominated for five different categories at this year's Tonys, including Tala's nomination for Best Performance by a Featured Actress in a Play. Welcome to All Sides.
Thanks, Amy.
So first of all, congratulations on your nomination. What a massive achievement. What was your reaction when you found out you were nominated for a Tony?
Shock to begin with, and then total delight coupled with the other four nominations for the show. It was so nice to be recognized because at that point we had actually been closed for, I think, 2 months. So it was nice to know that the show was held in people's memory enough to get these five nominations.
Now, I know that you didn't win, but what was it like? What was it like to be at the Tony event and all the parties and dressing up? Tell me about that experience for you.
It was wonderful, and it was a very strange experience where I had to think about fashion a lot. but it was really lovely, and the actual event, I really made a point to stay present for it. And in that, I remember in the moment that they were announcing my category, I really felt an incredible presence of mind and an ability to see how remarkable this moment was that I was sitting in and part of for this play that I'm so proud of. Mm.
To pivot just a little bit, you were born in Iran, but you were raised in Powell here in central Ohio.
Yes, first Columbus and then Powell.
Okay. So do you call Columbus home or Powell home, both?
You know, I say Columbus because I think more people know Columbus. But yeah, about half my life was half of my childhood was Columbus and half in Powell.
Okay. How did growing up here in central Ohio impact your acting career? Did you, as a child, did you act in plays around Central Ohio?
I didn't really. I grew up in a very artistically inclined family, so there was always painting and music in our house. But it wasn't until I had a drama teacher in high school that was wonderful and really changed my life. I was reading Arthur Miller and Lorraine Hansberry. And, you know, I initially took on drama as an extracurricular to, you know, pad my college applications. And I ended up falling in love with it and being really fascinated by it and wanting to be better at it. And along with all the, you know, Ivy League liberal arts schools that I applied to, I ended up also applying to Boston University for acting and decided to go down that path.
Which high school did you go to?
I went to a school that is no longer exists, but it was called Village Academy in Powell, Ohio.
Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah, I've heard of that. I've been around.
Non-denominational private school. Yeah.
So did you act in plays whenever you were in high school?
I sure did. I acted in such plays as All My Sons and The Odd Couple, the female version. I believe I directed a Neil Simon play my senior year. So yeah, primarily I did plays in high school, and then I ended up going to a pre-college theater program my junior year at Carnegie Mellon, which sort of set me up to audition for the next step.
No, oh, Carnegie Mellon might be a little bit known for that. Yeah, got it.
Yes, yes.
So how did your parents feel about your career? Were they supportive? Did they want an actor for their daughter to become an actor?
Yeah, you know, I think the stereotype is that immigrant parents want their children to be doctors and engineers, and there is certainly truth in that, but not in my house. Again, I grew up surrounded by the arts. Being from Iran, it was sort of the part of our culture that we could bring with us. We didn't have our extended family, but we had, you know, miniature paintings, and like my dad was playing sitar, you know, Persian instrument in our house. So art was very loved and encouraged. And I'm an only child. And despite that, when I said to my parents that I wanted to go to acting school, they were, you know, incredibly supportive in a way that's sort of baffling to me now that I'm older. And they have really not skipped a step and you know, cheering me along all the way. They had a viewing party for the Tonys with that same high school drama teacher.
Nice.
In Powell, Ohio. So I really couldn't ask for more supportive parents.
Now, you were nominated for that Tony, and the play was called English, which is a play that centers on themes of cultural identity and assimilation. How did you relate to those themes through your character?
So the play is dealing with language, and it's Iranians in Iran trying to learn English, and you're watching that all in the English language. There's a device where we speak in an accent when we're trying to speak real English. It's a little bit hard to explain. But my character specifically really struggles with learning the English language and resents the fact that she needs to do that in order for the next part of her life to happen. And she's very ambitious and wants to become a doctor in Australia in her case. And so I really identified with this, with the anger actually that the character had of needing to, in her case, learn this language. And in my case, growing up, feeling a need to assimilate, feeling a need to be like everyone else, which is something I continue to try to break free of. But essentially, the play is really about how difficult it is to communicate and, you know, what we lose when we try to learn a language, or when we encounter someone in the world who is speaking with an accent or English as their second language, the assumptions that we make about them. And I grew up seeing people, you know, make those assumptions about my parents who do speak with accents. And so there was a lot to kind of plug into with this play that felt deeply personal, and enraging, honestly.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking with Tala Hash. She is from Central Ohio and recently celebrated her first Tony nomination as featured actress in a play. Do you get to visit Ohio very often? Do you come back here, or do you make your parents come to you?
It's about 50-50. I love coming back. I love going to Fox in the Snow and Dan the Baker. I have like my spots in Columbus that I really love.
Those are good spots, yeah.
Oh, good spots, right? And it's been really interesting to see how much Columbus has grown and changed since I grew up there. And I really, I don't know, I love Columbus.
We have quite the theater scene. Would you ever come back and act here in a play if offered?
I didn't know that was true. Is there a theater scene?
Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah, the Short North Stage does a great job. And we have lots of small theater companies. Absolutely. Next time you're here, look up a play.
I will. I would be happy to have my housing prepared.
Yes, I just saw Actors Theater in Schiller Park, too. They do a great
amazing.
Job. Yeah. Well, you've had a wide variety of roles, not just in the theater world. As the World Turns, American Odyssey, Legends of Tomorrow. Those are just a few. Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite role that you've had so far?
Yeah. Legends of Tomorrow that you mentioned, it was a TV show that I was on for 5 years, and I played the first Muslim American superhero on television. And this character was really fun, and it was a really fun, irreverent show in a lot of ways, but in terms of representation, which is something that I'm passionate about, we were able to portray this character that, you know, happened to be Muslim American, but it wasn't sort of the headline of her personality or you know, what she was doing day to day. And I think that was really humanizing and was representation that I hadn't seen quite in that way. So I'm really proud of that work that we did on that show. And it was, again, genuinely silly and fun and a delight to be a part of.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you had a favorite role and if that differed from what character you felt most connected to. Is that the same?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of television, it would be that. In terms of theater, it would be the part that I just played, Alham. But I think it's these characters that, like all of us, are very nuanced and textured and funny and sad and, you know, the sort of like representing the gamut of what it is to be alive on this earth. And, you know, often as a Middle Eastern actor, I've encountered a lot of very flattening roles that are sort of stereotypical. So when I get to play a truly three-dimensional character, that's my preference, and those would be my favorite roles.
Mm. Now, as a musical theater geek myself from high school age, my favorite role that you have been in was on the TV show Smash. So for listeners who don't know, that show is about a group of characters creating a Broadway musical and the all-consuming, demanding theater life. What was it like to be on Smash?
Oh my God, so fun. Of course, at the time, I didn't know it was, you know, going to be this sort of cult classic. But it was weird and wonderful, and we shot in New York. And I remember just coming to work one day and like doing a Bollywood dance number next to Angelica Houston and thinking, you know, what is my life in the best way.
Now, did that show, being on that show, prepare you for whenever you decided to take on a big role, like a lead actress in a play like English? I mean, did you know the demands of the theater life?
You know, honestly, I think what prepared me is years of doing plays, off Broadway, you know, all those things where you like get your equity card in a, you know, 50 seat theater. These are the things that then make, you know, the huge Broadway theater feel a little less daunting, that you have your 10,000 hours, so to speak, to do that. So yeah, it was a lot of hours off Broadway doing some great work and some not so great work. And, you know, I think it allowed me to recognize how special this play was and how truly excellent it was, and to get to be part of it is, I think, the kind of dream that all actors have in the theater.
Do you only on Smash, or do you musical theater, sing and dance?
Well, Amy, I have done musical theater, but I wouldn't say it's my, foremost talent. Honestly, I can sing, but I'm not going to sit here and pretend that I have the chops to do what these incredible musical theater people do 8 times a week. I don't have that particular skill set, but like, you know, gently strumming up with a ukulele, like I could probably do that maybe 5 times a week.
Okay. Now, you mentioned at the beginning of us talking that you found out you were nominated after English had closed. So are you going to bring it back? I mean, I know sometimes getting a bunch of Tony nominations gets buzz back up about something.
Yeah, you know, I think there are some plans, not necessarily in New York, but there might be the possibility of, you know, bringing the Broadway production elsewhere. I have not heard any plans of it happening again in New York, but that would be wonderful.
Yeah. Do a lot of, I mean, I'm sure people ask you about it. Ever since you were nominated, they were probably like, oh no, I missed it. Do you hear that a lot?
I do, unfortunately, hear that, yes.
Yes. Well, besides maybe possibly bringing English back, do you have any upcoming projects that you're working on now that you'd like to talk about?
You know, right now I'm workshopping a lot of things that are coming down the pipeline, but I don't think I can actually mention any of them. I'm trying to think right now. You know, recently I did an episode of a great TV show on FX called Adults. that I think is really, I'm basically a cameo, but it was really, really fun to do. And I think it's a really brilliant show. So that's something you could see me on right now.
Okay. Okay. So you have some secret projects you can't talk about yet.
Yeah. That sounds more maybe riveting than it deserves, but yes, yes, there's, life of an actor.
Well, and then on behalf of my grandmother, I have to ask you about what it was like to be on As the World Turns, because, she loved the soaps. So.
Oh, I'm sorry to your grandmother. I didn't have a great time on that particular show. The people were absolutely lovely, but sort of going back to this idea of like stereotypes, being asked to portray stereotypes, I was very young and I said yes to this role that ended up sort of being a nightmare of a stereotype.
So,
it wasn't, in terms of the actual work, it was really difficult, but taught me a lot, about how important it is to say no and to be really, judicious about what you choose. But the people there were lovely. And actually, I still see everyone around. And there, there's this, tapestry of people, so much time that elapsed during that show that I do love that I am part of that tapestry.
Do you like theater or TV more? Do you, if you could pick your favorite genre?
They're so, so, so different. I think ultimately, I appreciate that in theater, you often get a little bit more collaborative time to work on the piece. And with TV, you sort of do that individually and then come on set and sort of quickly have to, collaborate as a group. So I love them both, but I think I like doing this work because I like sort of being part of a village and a community. And so sometimes I would say theater kind of ticks that box slightly more.
That was Tala Hash, a Tony-nominated actress, and she's from Central Ohio, both Columbus and Powell. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Amy.
And this has been Fascinating Ohio from All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich, and this is Fascinating Ohio, a show where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. Dozens of Navy sailors are in Columbus this week, promoting their military branch and celebrating its 250th anniversary. Overseeing Navy Week events is Rear Admiral Matthew Pottenberg, a Galena native and a graduate of Ohio State University. The week-long event kicked off Monday at COSI with a meteorology event and will culminate with the Blue Angels aerial performance at this weekend's Columbus Air Show. Welcome to All Sides, Rear Admiral.
Thank you so much, Amy. It's great to be here.
So what's it like to be back in town? Do you get back here very often?
I do. So I still have lots of family here. I have my daughter, who's an incoming sophomore at The Ohio State University. My sister's here with my nieces and nephews and both of our dads. So my father-in-law and my father are both right here in Westerville and in Delaware. So we do get back quite a bit. We try to catch as many Ohio State games as I'm able to. But it's super great to be back here for Navy Week.
Yeah, and once a Buckeye, always a Buckeye.
That
I'm
is
sure.
100% correct,
yeah.
Yes.
But campus looks a little bit different, I'm thinking.
It does. It does. It looks a lot different. Earlier I was out at Polaris. That all kind of bloomed in 1996, right as I was graduating Ohio State. And so every time I go out there and just see the how everything is expanding is pretty exciting.
Everything is there. So before we get into this week's events, I want to know a bit more about your early years in Ohio. When did you decide to pursue a military career?
So that's a great question. So it started with my grandfather. So my grandfather was a chief petty officer in World War II. My father grew up in Connecticut, and so his father, again, my grandfather, was a chief petty officer. And so we would go, I would go visit him back in Connecticut every summer. And he would tell stories of World War II. He was enlisted in the United States Navy in 1936. He came to boot camp in Great Lakes, which is where I now live, in 1937. And he served on the USS Bunker Hill, which is an aircraft carrier, and involved in every major conflict in the Pacific, and culminated in the Battle of Okinawa when it was hit by two kamikazes. And but for the grace of God, he survived. And a whole bunch of stories he would always tell me. And I knew from an early age that the Navy just sounded like very awesome to me, and specifically naval aviation. And so that was kind of the first kind of fire that was lit in me. Of note, my father moved away from Connecticut, and he came and went to school at Otterbein in Westerville, which is how I met my mother. And so that's kind of my connection. My mom went to Upper Arlington just a few years ahead of Jack Nicklaus. And so I grew up here. And to get to your question, so I knew that Navy was something I wanted to do, but I never really was talked to by a recruiter, which is totally kind of strange to even say. And a chance encounter, my first week here at Ohio State, I bumped into a guy who I'd gone to church with like 5 years ago. He was in a Navy uniform. He had just come back from flight school, and he was wearing NFO, Naval Flight Officer wings, just like the ones I wear today. And I bumped into him, and he said, "Hey, come on down with me to the ROTC unit." And that was like the first time somebody told me how to actually connect to the Navy.
Okay.
And I went to the ROTC unit, and the rest, that was 34 years ago now.
When you say ROTC, are you saying ROTC?
ROTC, yeah. Okay. Navy yeah. Reserve Officer Training Corps at Ohio State.
So just inviting you.
Invited me to come down, and he said, "Hey,
And he changed your life.
Changed my life. Changed the entire, as I say, the Navy changed the entire trajectory of my life, and the rest is history. So it's been fantastic.
So you're going on 30 years. What's your day-to-day job like? Because I read you have logged 3,000 hours in various aircraft. So day-to-day, do you still fly?
Sure. So not this tour. So what the Navy does is for whatever your primary job is in the Navy, mine is a naval flight officer, so flying. P-3s and P-8s is the two types of airplanes, and now a new one, which is called the Triton. All of it is around anti-submarine warfare, so hunting submarines. Like, that's my day job. We do that kind of every other tour. So you fly, and then the Navy, as an officer, they send you to do something else kind of in corporate Navy, and then you fly, corporate Navy, fly. So I've been doing that for 29 years. So I don't fly right now, but my day job is the commander of Naval Service Training Command. I live in Great Lakes, which is the home of our Navy's one and only boot camp. We send about 44,000 recruits through boot camp a year. Every Thursday, 1,000 of them graduate. That's one of the things I do. That's number one. The second thing is I'm in charge of all of the Navy ROTC units and colleges. There's 78 of those across the nation. And Navy JROTC is the third thing I do. I'm in charge of those. There's just under 800 of Navy junior ROTC units in our local high schools. One's in Grove City. I'll be meeting with them on Friday. Another one's in Franklin Heights. We have them in Central Ohio. Again, we have just under 800 in the nation, some overseas. And the final thing is my day job, which is in Newport, Rhode Island, which is Officer Candidate School and Officer Development School, which is where young men and women that already have college degrees that don't go to the academy or don't go to a ROTC unit in a college that already have a degree decide they want to serve as an officer, and they go to a boot camp-like experience there for anywhere between 5 to 13 weeks, and we commission them as officers. It's also where we get our doctors, our nurses, our lawyers, and our chaplains in the United States Navy. So those are my four things I do in my day job.
You're not busy at all.
I'm not busy at all.
So Navy Week is an annual tradition, and you visit visiting 15 cities a year since 2005. So that's why you're here right now. So far this year, several other cities have hosted Navy Week ahead of Columbus, Duluth, Minnesota, Anchorage, Alaska. How are the cities picked for Navy Week?
So it's every few years they kind of have a rotation. It's all about connection. And so we always pick, you know, cities that have a strong kind of Navy, you know, foundation or heritage. And it's all about, you know, coming back and kind of sharing what the Navy does for them on a daily basis. We were last here in 2009. So as I joked with the mayor and the Lieutenant Governor Tressel just a little bit ago, you know, a little too long. You know, it's been a while. It's good that we're back. And so it's a fantastic opportunity, like I said, to come back. We have about 100 sailors that are all from Ohio or Central Ohio that have all come back. We bring them all back. They get out in the community, tons of community service, Habitat for Humanity, YMCA, counseling mentorship sessions of young people. It's a fantastic opportunity to get out. We brought the Navy Band with us from Virginia. And so they're out playing all over. You already mentioned a few of the events. The air show was huge with the Blue Angels, Navy United Clippers, Columbus Crew game on Saturday. And COSI, I'm super excited about COSI because as a little boy, I spent most of my summers at COSI.
Yeah.
Overnights and sleepovers. I was in Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts. We did a ton of events at COSI. We're doing a super cool event where we're handing out Navy STEM kits to young boys and girls that come out. So lots of great events. Oh, and you can Google it, Navy Outreach, Navy Community Outreach, Columbus, or Columbus Navy Week, and get the whole list of events.
All right, so Columbus Navy Week. This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking about Navy Week in Columbus with Rear Admiral Matthew Pottenberg. So we did a show late last year on military recruitment and efforts to boost the ranks, and it's been challenging for some branches more than others. What about the Navy? How do you see recruitment numbers?
Recruitment is actually going fantastic. So, you know, part of to your question about what is it you do for your day job, you know, my job is to train 40,600 men and women to put them through boot camp. And we're on track right now to end up with about little under 45,000. So recruiting for us has been going great. We've hit this year. We've consistently been ahead in recruiting, which is fantastic. I don't own the recruiting side. I have somebody else that does that. But when they do, they get recruited and they get sent to me at Great Lakes. They go through a 9-week boot camp, you know, training with me, and then after that, we send them off to their technical schools. To do whatever they're going to do in the Navy. And the cool part about the Navy, which is one of the things I love, is it doesn't much matter what you want to do. The Navy's got that job. There's 150 jobs for enlisted, and there's 126 or so jobs for officers. And it's a pretty fun game when I get out to the local high schools to talk to the NJROTCs. I always get that question. Will the Navy let me do? And they do. And so I will... We go, raise your hand if you have a job, and I haven't been stumped yet, just to give you an idea. And even there's some pretty obscure jobs I've gotten, and there's always a tie into the Navy. And so it's just a ton of great. And frankly, I think 75% or so of them on the enlisted side are all STEM related. And so it's just a fantastic opportunity for young men and women. If they'd like to serve, we'd love to have them.
When I think of Ohio and Columbus, at least parts of Ohio, we think very landlocked. You don't think Navy.
Yes.
So you recruit everywhere, though.
You
can find future sailors even in the middle of with no water.
That's exactly right. I in fact, the mayor said that, and I joked with him after. He said, you know, we're a landlocked. I said, no, you're just counting the Olentangy. Come on, man.
You know, that's a big one. Yeah.
But in all seriousness, yes. You know, we'll you know, if, we call it the propensity to serve. If a young man or woman has a propensity to serve, they want to raise their right hand and join, whether it's an officer enlisted, we'd love to have them. We'll work really hard to get you in whatever job that you'd like to do, which is fantastic. I started my journey 34 years ago, 29 of it active duty, and it's been a blast. So to your point, you know, grew up in Galena as I 352 people, and then I left to go to flight school 351, and you know, I knew a couple counties, you know, Delaware, Franklin, maybe Knox. And 29 years later, I've been to 6 of the 7 continents and so close to 70 countries. It's just been amazing journey in the Navy.
You mentioned the outreach efforts that the Navy is doing, and you mentioned the STEM kits, distributing 250 STEM kits. Is this the educational outreach to get kids understanding? Do you need to reach them at a younger age? Because you had a chance encounter in college, but you can reach them younger.
Sure, I think so. I think, you know, any opportunity for us to kind of share an opportunity is a fantastic one. You know, I look at my own experience kind of to your question. I was never contacted by a recruiter. My high school didn't have a JROTC. And if it wasn't for that chance encounter my first week in, you know, at Ohio State, who knows what I'd be doing. But it is an opportunity, again, for us to connect to Columbus. Columbus has got a rich history in the United States Navy. A lot of folks don't even realize. I just found out that, you know, one of our first fighters in World War II was almost all of them, you know, were built right here. You know, they're called the Hell Divers is the name of the airplane, but they were built in Columbus, Ohio. I just found that out. You know, John Glenn, Neil Armstrong, Jim Lovell, who I just met a week before he passed away in Illinois, all born and raised in Ohio. You know, the entire moon program basically came from Central Ohio. Pretty cool.
We like the moon here in Ohio.
Yes, yeah. That's right. And so just a great opportunity for us to come back and share our story.
So your events of Navy Week will culminate with the Columbus Air Show August 22nd through the 24th at Rickenbacker International Airport, featuring the U.S. Navy Flight Demonstration Squadron, the Blue Angels. So tell me about that. What can people see whenever if they go to see to the air show for the Blue Angels?
Sure. So this air show is actually pretty amazing. It's got all kinds of events. And so I'll probably conclude what I'll say about the Blue Angels, but the great part about an air show is it's not just Navy. All the services are represented. The Ohio Air National Guard is going to be flying here. A couple different airplanes, the C-17 and a KC-135 tanker. The Air Force and the Navy both have their F-35. That's our newest generation airplane. Have their air demo teams that are going to be here. The Coast Guard is going to be flying some of their rescue helicopters. There's some pretty amazing for the vintage crowd, you know, from the World War II, from my grandfather's. There's an old bomber. There's going to be a P-51 Mustang, which was flown by the Army Air Corps. They're going to be flying. And then there's even some pretty cool stuff on the ground. They call them the land demonstration. There's some hot rods and racers and things like that. But I'll tell you, on the Blue Angels side, to go back to here, I first saw the Blue Angels in 1985 at the Dayton Air Show as a little boy. And I loved airplanes. I always did airplane models and things like that. And again, back to one of my youth pastors, he was a big airplane model guy. He took me to the Dayton Air Show, and I was, I think, 12 or so at the time. That was the first time I saw the Blue Angels. And I've seen them now. That was the first time. And in 29 years, I've seen them probably hundreds and hundreds of times. It's just an incredible experience. It puts me right back to 1985, looking at them doing their demonstration. They fly about 18 inches apart, which is pretty amazing. They go supersonic. You're going to see all kinds of things. They have a low air show and a high air show. It depends upon the cloud cover. Both of them are different. Both of them are amazing. And in true Ohio fashion, the weather's going to change. So if you come Friday, Saturday, Sunday, you might see all of the shows. Yeah. But it's pretty amazing. And they always do a great job of being there till every little boy and little girl wants to shake their hand and sign it, autograph, or take a photo with them. They'll be there till the very end. They always do a great job talking to the community.
And for moviegoers, the most famous Navy men may be from the Top Gun movie. You know, Tom Cruise, Val Kilmer played Maverick and Iceman. Do you get sick of people asking about Top Gun?
No, of course not. I love Top Gun. As I joke and say, you know, my grandfather was responsible for probably 90% of the Navy, and the other 10% was when I watched Top Gun and you know, at junior high school kind of age when it first came out. And then, of course, with the reboot, you know, the Maverick movie is fantastic, and I absolutely love it. And it does a great job of showing the how awesome naval aviation is and the Navy. So I'm all in on Top Gun.
Will you be meeting with Ohio State's own Top Gun, President Ted Carter?
I am looking forward to that. So I'll be doing a bunch of events across the campus, and I am meeting with President, formerly Vice Admiral, now retired, Ted Slapshot Carter. So I'm looking forward to getting to see Slapshot.
Yeah. Is there anything else about Navy Week that you want to tell me before we end here?
I would say, again, back to the 100 sailors that are out, you're going to see them in the summer whites like I'm wearing right now, or Navy PT gear that's easy because it's a bright yellow shirt that says Navy on it. They're here to talk to y'all. So anybody that, you know, if you got questions about the Navy, this isn't recruiting. It's just, hey, what do you do for the Navy? They'd love to share their story and tell you all about what they do. They're going to be in the community doing tons of volunteer service. So I would share that. And then again, it's super special to be here, not only because of this is where I was born and raised, but it is the 250th birthday of the United States Navy. And that's a pretty big deal. You know, for 2.5 centuries, the Navy's been, you know, forward deployed all the time. Deterring aggression, providing freedom of the seas, as I like to say, on, under, and above the sea, in space and in cyberspace. You know, $2.3 trillion of trade and global commerce goes via the sea. 95% of communications is on undersea cables. All of that is protected every single day by the United States Navy, and it's a pretty cool responsibility. And again, that's why we're here, is to share that with folks that we protect. And yeah, happy birthday, United States Navy.
Well, thank you for joining us today. We've been talking with Rear Admiral Matthew Pottenberg from Galena. He's a Galena native and a graduate of Ohio State University. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Amy.
And coming up, we're going to talk about the indie music scene with a local writer who has a new book. That's when Fascinating Ohio from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
Your business can become a WOSU underwriter. Our listeners say they prefer to do business with organizations that support public media. Like you, our listeners strive to make a difference in their communities through activism, education, and support of charitable organizations. You can reach these loyal listeners with your messaging when your business supports WOSU programs as an underwriter. For more information, visit wosu.org/support.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And this is Fascinating Ohio, a show where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. Chris DeVille of Worthington is the managing editor of Stereo Gum, an independently owned and operated music blog founded in 2002. He's also a former staff writer for Columbus Alive, where he covered topics in the Columbus music scene. And he's the author of a new book, out this week, Such Great Heights, The Complete Cultural History of the Indie Rock Explosion. There's a local launch event on August 27th at Used Kids Records. Chris DeVille, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks for having me.
So how long have you worked in or been writing about or been attached to the music business?
Oh, well, I started writing about the music business for the college newspaper at OU, The Post. So that would have been like 2002. When I came in as a freshman, I pretty much immediately went to the college newspaper office and was like, let me write about music. And by the spring, I was able to, you know, get my foot in the door for that. So, yeah, it's been, I guess, coming on. It's more than 20 years at this point. Did some interning for the Dispatch during college also, and then ended up at Columbus Alive in 2006. And yeah, it was kind of wheels up from there. I mean, when I was at Alive, I was covering all kinds of stuff, too. I wrote about the crew and sort of whatever was going on around town. But music was always kind of the focus, and it's always been kind of the through line. I've never stopped being a voracious music fan, and I've been lucky enough to be able to cover music as a journalist and a critic. So, yeah, we're going on 25 years now, I guess.
Have you found your niche as a music writer? Or have you been in a band? Do you play? Or,
you know, I did play in some bands. I had a band in college called Fine Dining, and I played in a band with some friends around town while I worked at Alive called The Compressions. You know, at this point, the only music that I ever play is some other dads on my street in Worthington. We have a cover band that plays once a year at the neighborhood festival. yeah. We just pretty much call it ourselves the dad band. So yeah, I mean, I played music on and off, and I certainly had my dreams of, you know, being the kind of band that I write about. But it turns out that I'm better at writing about the music than I am at making the music. So
Most of us are, yes. So you are the managing editor of music news at the entertainment site Stereo Gum. Tell me about Stereo Gum. What is it? What's its main focus?
So Stereo Gum, my boss Scott Lapatine started Stereo Gum in New York in 2002. It was his live journal at first. I don't know if people remember that platform. It was like a, you know, early blogging platform. And it was an MP3 blog at first. So in the 2000s, there were kind of a flurry of blogs that were just, you know, posting new MP3s of new music. And kind of Stereo Gum ended up airing on the side of indie rock. that was, you know, was kind of tied into this whole moment when indie rock was kind of exploding that I wrote about in the book. And so Stereogum has kind of evolved to become kind of more professional, more of a professional operation with the staff. And we've been through a couple parent companies, and then Scott bought the site back in 2019. And so now we're kind of a tight ship, a small, scrappy independent company, but we're hanging on. And yeah, we cover a lot of different music. We post new songs every day. We post news like tour announcements, or, you know, if two artists are feuding, or, you know, we'll do obituaries. But then we also have, we have album reviews. We have the album of the week every week, or we'll do, you know, we'll review anticipated new albums for our readers. We have interviews. I've interviewed a lot of artists, you know, like Wilco is probably the band I've seen the most in my life. So I interviewed Jeff Tweedy from Wilco for Stereogum. I've interviewed Run the Jewels and Tame Impala and Britt Daniel from Spoon. Just those kinds of artists are kind of like our core. We're definitely still err on the side of indie rock as like our baseline. Mm-hmm. But I was also the columnist. I wrote a column called The Week in Pop for 8 years, where I was writing about mainstream pop. We have a rap columnist, we have a metal columnist, we have a jazz columnist, and, you know, we try to venture into, it might be more appropriate to say that even though indie rock is the focus, it's like, kind of like whatever hipsters are into, we try to, you know, kind of have a handle on it, so sometimes that means something besides indie rock.
All right. Well, speaking of hipsters, let's talk about your book. So your book is Such Great Heights, The Complete Cultural History of the Indie Rock Explosion. What was your initial motivation to write a book?
So I was thinking, like, this story that I'm telling in the book, it feels like something that I sort of know intuitively from living it. And it's something that has played out online largely, like, in blog posts and social media posts and message boards, and like a lot of dead links that you have to access with the Wayback Machine. And it felt like it was worth compiling it into sort of a more permanent document. But it also felt like, you know, we've seen a lot of histories of the 2000s starting to pop up. Like, there's a book called Meet Me in the Bathroom that's an oral history of New York around the time of the Strokes and the Yeah Yeah Yeahs and Interpol and all of that. And I felt like there wasn't as much documentation yet of kind of the aftermath of that big boom that happened in the 2000s. So the book starts with, like, the Strokes and the OC and MySpace and all of this stuff that happens in the 2000s. And over the course of that decade, there was this morphing that happened where indie rock sort of started to transform into a kind of pop music. And the definition of indie, it was already blurry to begin with, but then it just got blurrier and blurrier. And to the point where you get to the early 2010s and you've got sort of indie pop stars popping up. Mm-hmm. You've got a lot of bands sort of trying to become pop bands that were, you know, coming out of an indie background. And yeah, I felt like that was a really interesting development. That's kind of where things were at in 2013 when I came on staff at Stereogum. And it was just such a fascinating time in indie music. And yeah, so we kind of got to the point where during COVID, Taylor Swift released Folklore, and she worked on it with people from indie bands like The National and Bon Iver. And people were like, this is Taylor Swift's indie album. And I mean, obviously,
does Taylor Swift get to be indie, though?
Right. That's the thing. Like, she's the biggest pop star in the world. So, like, if even she is indie, then does indie even mean anything? And so, yeah, the book kind of became a study of, like, how the word indie has evolved and been stretched and kind of almost rendered meaningless, and like all of the sort of cultural factors that swirled around that. And
but like, indie is supposed to mean independent,
right?
But
yes.
Like, what is anyone independent if you are on a record label, right?
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, so the book starts, I kind of establish what was indie when I came to it, like circa Y2K. So in the 80s and the 90s, you had indie meant like, yes, you're on an independent record label or you're not on a record label at all. It means you're independent. But even then, it kind of was also a genre. Like there were certain types of bands that were often celebrated in indie zines, which were kind of like do-it-yourself magazines that got played on college radio, that there was kind of an aesthetic element to it too. It wasn't just a business model was indie, but then and every once in a while you'll have a wave of indie bands come up from the underground and permeate the mainstream. And so like probably the most famous example of that is Nirvana in the early 90s and all of the grunge bands. And so you had a whole wave in the 90s of these underground bands kind of blowing up. And where my book picks up is sort of the next wave of bands that came up in the early 2000s and sort of how they caught on and how the culture around them evolved and how the impact that they had on the mainstream and also the impact that the mainstream had on them.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides, and our guest is Chris DeVille of Worthington. He's the managing editor of Stereo Gum, which is an independently owned and operated music blog, and he's the author of a new book, Such Great Heights, The Complete Cultural History of the Indie Rock Explosion. Now, you could have titled your book a lot of different things. There's a lot of great song titles out there. So Such Great Heights is the Postal Service song, or perhaps you prefer Iron and Wine. Why this title?
I felt like Such Great Heights accomplished, it said a lot about sort of the story I was trying to tell. My original subtitle for the book was How Indie Rock Went Pop. And so the Postal Service is Ben Gibbard from Death Cab for Cutie. He teamed with an electronic producer, Jimmy Tamborello, and in 2003, they released their one and only album, and the big hit off of it was Such Great Heights. And I felt like, okay, so this is an early example of this wave of indie bands kind of putting down their guitars, picking up their synthesizers, warming up to the idea of going pop. And so it fit into the theme of the book in that way. It helped to kind of create this lane for these poppier indie bands to exist. But also it just felt like Such Great Heights, it's how high these bands soared. They soared to a level that they never would have thought possible. But I do say at the end of the book that I could have easily called it Losing My Edge as well, which is the LCD Sound System song, because like part of what I'm grappling with is like, as these bands, as this whole scene transformed, what did it gain? What did it lose? What was good about it blowing up? What was bad about it blowing up? And there's questions about gatekeeping, and there's questions about capitalism, and there's questions about if you're a person who defines yourself as being on the cutting edge, what do you do when everybody starts to like the stuff that you like? Then you react against that, and you find a new thing. And so there's I'm charting trends. I'm charting kind of like the attitudes of the indie rock audience, which is often a very like kind of hipster heavy audience. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of different factors that are at play, but it felt like Such Great Heights was a good catch all.
So I read a description of your book that calls it a time machine for millennials. So I sit here as an elder millennial, very elder, and I agree. It was a blast from the past. Your book made me think of freshman year of college with illegal downloads and burned CDs in the car, right? Who's the audience for your book? An elder millennial like me?
Yeah, I think, anybody who's a millennial, I'm on the elder side of millennials as well. But I think, me and my editor tried to shape it in a way where you could read this and see your life reflected back to you, even if you weren't listening to like Arcade Fire and Sufjan Stevens. We tried to connect this stuff to larger storylines and culture, and tech is a big part of it. I talk about AOL Instant Messenger, I talk about Napster and iTunes and MySpace and the emergence of social media and Spotify, like that. There's a whole like shadow topic of tech that runs through the book, which is like something that has touched all of our lives. And I talk about fashion and how the sort of like thrift store hipster wardrobe became, you know, it kind of filtered its way into Urban Outfitters and then eventually into like Target. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we talk about like the indie sleaze thing that people were excited about a couple of years ago, like the whole fashion side of that. That's represented in the book as well.
Before we run out of time, I want to talk about your book launch event. So August 27th, Use Kid Records. What's that going to entail?
So I'm going to be at Use Kids Records with Prologue Bookshop sponsoring, and Rob Harvilla, who also lives in town. He works for The Ringer, and he hosts the podcast 60 Songs That Explain the 90s, and now it's 60 Songs That Explain the 90s, colon the 2000s. I'm actually on the most recent episode, so check it out. But he's going to be hosting the event, basically talking to me more about the book. We're going to have a signing. We're going to have Q&A. It should be great. Maybe people can buy some records while they're there, too.
Yeah, and I'm going to just end. We only have 30 seconds left, but, you know, reading your book made me feel like I need to break out some CDs from 25 years ago, maybe some Sufjan Stevens. What would you recommend I listen to tonight?
Oh, man. I would say maybe The National, Boxer by The National. That's a good one.
Yeah. All right. Chris DeVille of Worthington. He is the managing editor of Stereo Gum, an independently owned and operated music blog. And he is the author of the new book, Such Great Heights, The Complete Cultural History of the Indie Rock Explosion. Chris, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
This has been Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. And I'm Amy Jurevich. And if you missed any part of today's show, listen back at wosu.org/allsides. You can also subscribe to our podcast or listen for free using the WOSU mobile app. Be sure to follow All Sides on Facebook. You can follow the show on Instagram at All Sides WOSU. You can see some behind-the-scenes pictures. Thanks for joining us today for All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.